final argument set today is in the case of Cali versus West Valley City, docket 18-40-61. Counsel, we're prepared to hear your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor, and Your Honors, and may it please the court, Daniel Pazinski representing the appellant, Sean Cowley. Your Honors, my client pursued two causes of action which are at issue on this appeal, a cause of action for a due process violation and a cause of action for retaliatory prosecution. The lower court dismissed both causes of action on summary judgment.
And we pull your microphone down a little bit.
Okay.
Just pull, yeah, good.
Thank you, Your Honor. The lower court dismissed both causes of action on summary judgment, and we would respectfully request that this court overturn dismissal.
Well, let's talk about the due process.
Okay.
He got notice of the charges.
Yes.
Okay. He was given an explanation of the city's evidence.
Correct.
He was given an opportunity to respond.
Correct.
He could present evidence on his side of the story.
Yes.
And so the only thing left is you're saying that the decision maker was biased.
Correct.
Okay, is there anything that says that the guy can't have a sort of a predisposition, but if he's willing to listen to the evidence and come up with a decision based on the evidence, that that's all the due process you're entitled to?
Yes, Your Honor, that is the case law. There is no due process violation if somebody predetermines a discipline, so long as that preference is subject to revision.
Right.
The issue here is that there is evidence that the predetermination by the city manager, Wayne Powell, was not subject to revision. Prior to his predetermination hearing with Deputy Chief Marks, which was the individual that was picked to be the final decision maker on this case, the city manager announced at a city council meeting that anything less than termination for Sean Cowley would be inappropriate. There is that pre-termination hearing, and the appointed decision maker decides that termination is not appropriate, that 240 hours of administrative leave would actually be the correct remedy. He proposes that to the city manager. The city manager rejects that. So he submits an additional letter recommending termination because that is what the city manager requested. So this isn't just a case where there is a preference, there's a pre-termination hearing, and then that preference happens, because that's not a due process violation in and of itself.
So what if there was a predetermination subject to revision that termination was appropriate, and after hearing all the evidence, instead of there being a dispute between the city manager and the hearing officer about what the appropriate punishment would be, there would have just been a termination decision, then you don't have a due process violation then, do you?
We wouldn't have the evidence to show, and that was actually one of the issues in Quails. Quails, the city manager comes in, announces that that's his preference, termination. They pursued a due process violation based on biased tribunal. That in and of itself is insufficient. The difference with this case is that there is evidence that this decision was not subject to revision. And that's shown by the fact that the appointed final decision maker ultimately did not get his way.
Well, of what significance is it that then he went on and filed his suit and it was settled and he got $88,000+ in back salary plus $30,000+ in retirement benefits?
Yes,
Your Honor. What does that do to the whole calculus?
So, as the lower court noted, one of their justifications for dismissal was that he was made whole by his reinstatement and the return of his lost salary, along with paid time off, holiday, overtime, and retirement benefits. Now, if that's all my client was entitled to for a due process violation, the lower court would have been correct. But a due process violation is not just limited to reinstatement and back pay. A due process violation includes, as categories of damages, all damages that naturally arrive from the termination, if the termination was unjustified, along with any emotional distress.
What did the settlement do?
So the settlement
settled the case.
Correct, Your Honor. Pursuant to Utah Code 10-3-1106, when Sean prevailed on his appeal, the magistrate needed to provide Sean with back pay. The settlement was limited to back pay. Mm-hmm. The settlement specifically provides for classes of relief, lost wages, paid time off, holiday, overtime, retirement, and then specifically excluded all other rights and damages. So it satisfies the requirements of 10-3-1106, but it doesn't make my client whole as to the due process violation, because it doesn't account for some of the other damages that arrive from due process. And I would also note, even if my client cannot establish damages, or if all damages were addressed in that settlement, the settlement does not waive his rights to pursue a claim for due process violation. And even if there are no damages associated with a due process violation, a client is still entitled to nominal damages just for the violation of the due process right. I hope that answers your question, Your Honor.
It seems like the problem with this is that your damages, all including the back pay and all those types of monetary damages, your emotional distress, your different kinds of damages, all flow from the same conduct.
Yes.
And I think, understanding you have a provision in here that says that neither party waives any rights except those expressly mentioned in this document. I mean, do you think normally, if you settled your case for back pay and some other incidental employment benefits, don't you think you would be giving up your right to damages, other damages that would flow from the same violation?
If there wasn't a settlement and my client had, if the magistrate had just decided a back pay amount pursuant to the statute, my position would be that my client has not waived any right to a due process violation, because the magistrate could not have provided my client with all of the relief that he was entitled to for the due process violation.
Okay.
Maybe he shouldn't have settled.
Well, that was certainly the lower court's opinion. Settlement agreements are typically interpreted strictly. There is nothing in this settlement agreement that waives any of the other damages that my client would be entitled to. There's nothing in the settlement agreement that waives his right to pursue a due process claim. If West Valley City wanted to negotiate for that, they certainly could have put that into the settlement agreement. They didn't. The other basis for dismissal was that the lower court found that my client was afforded all of his due process rights. We have kind of addressed it, but the issue was he was provided with the hearings. There's a question of fact as to whether the tribunal was fair.
Isn't that true in every case when you come down on the wrong side? They weren't fair.
Well, there certainly is an argument for that. But as your Honor, asked me at the onset, there's a difference between coming in with a preference for discipline and then acting on it, and then a case where there's evidence that preference was not subject to revision. And I think that's what it would be our position, that that's what we have here.
Well, the problem is that this is not just he beat somebody up. I can understand why a city manager or the main decision maker would be inclined to say, hey, you shot the guy 6 times for backing out his car. Well, yeah, but I thought he was going to run me over. Well, I can see where he would say, gosh, this is pretty serious. And so how are you ever going to be able to even make a fact situation about whether or not he was firmly committed to termination from the beginning?
Sure, Your Honor. As a point of clarification, the termination was not in relation to the shooting. It was in relation to the misconduct that was going within the NNU.
Right. But wasn't it all mixed together, though?
They made it a point to keep that separate.
Okay.
So we have to compare with my client all the other officers that were disciplined for similar misconduct. And then we have though Wayne Pyle was certainly had the right to terminate anybody, West Valley City Police Department policy was that the chief determined what that discipline was. Furthermore, he was assigned to that job, and he represented that he was the final decision maker. And the fact that he testified that the only reason why he made the recommendation of termination was because the city manager was pushing for that, I think that that's enough for that, for a factual dispute and for a trier of fact to make a determination as to what the city manager's mindset was. Moving on to the malicious prosecution claim, the lower court dismissed it on a number of reasons. I'll address them quickly here. First, they found that there was no intent, that there wasn't a retaliatory intent. Retaliatory intent is difficult to prove by direct evidence. That's generally why circumstantial evidence is what's allowed to establish retaliatory intent. And then it's a pretty liberal standard.
Well, hadn't the district attorney's office on that issue already made a decision, an independent decision, to charge him with manslaughter regardless of the city's desires?
So, Your Honor, I think that Hartman v. Moore is particularly instructive on this issue. Usually, if there is probable cause for the charge, the assumption is that everything went correctly within the DA's deliberative process. However, if there is evidence of retaliatory motive, inducement, which there is, because
it was after the fact, though, wasn't it? If there was any involvement,
well, there's a question as to when exactly Detective Greco made his recommendations. The lower court found that it was in October of 2013. We've argued that there's nothing in the record to establish that. That it's what it comes down to is nobody can recall exactly when this meeting was. Blake Nakamura, the head DA, prosecutor for the DA, could not recall when this recommendation was made, probably because there wasn't one big meeting. These recommendations were obtained piecemeal. But so there is evidence of inducement, not just in the fact that he advocated for it and the fact that he signed a probable cause statement. So retaliatory intent, inducement, and lack of probable cause, which was found by the lower court in the criminal case, all three of those, if you have those evidence to support that, establishes a prima facie case of retaliatory prosecution. The burden then shifts to the defendant to rebut that presumption. And there is actually quite a bit of evidence to show that this prosecution did not go at all like the regular process. The head detective for the DA's office, he was not, normally he would be the one to sign the information. He was not offered the information.
Yeah, but the DA didn't care who signed it.
True, Your Honor, but for some reason it wasn't given to the person that should have gotten it. It was given to West Valley City, who assigned a detective that didn't think there was probable cause for the crime. In addition, there is evidence to suggest that this was just a rubber stamp. DA Meister, who is a veteran DA or veteran prosecutor at the DA's office, he testified that the screening process for this charge was unlike anything he had ever seen. They didn't screen whether there was sufficient evidence for the charge. They only screened whether the probable cause statement was sufficient to bring charges.
What would happen with your claim if, by happenstance, Chris Dowland had signed instead of Detective Greco? Anything? Is that the end of your claim?
I would think that would certainly hurt our claim, Your Honor. I think there's still evidence of advocacy.
And Mr. Dowland was happy to sign, right? It's just a matter of who got the papers.
Yes, but there is also a question as to why the presumption is, when we've established retaliatory intent, advocacy, and lack of probable cause, that something went wrong in the process. There is no explanation for why it wasn't given to these people who allegedly were happy to sign it. It was instead given to West Valley City, and West Valley City handed it off to an officer that didn't think there was probable cause.
Wasn't it actually against West Valley City's best interest to have him charged?
And that's exactly the point. It doesn't make any sense for West Valley City to engage in this prosecution, give a detective that they knew did not think that criminal charges were warranted, and have him sign the information. Your Honors, I would like to save what time I have left for a rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. I want to address the settlement first off. So Mr. Cowley's attorney has represented to the court that this settlement allowed him to pursue additional damages. And that's not what the settlement provided for. The only reservation of rights states that neither party waives any rights except those expressly mentioned in this document. West Valley City wasn't giving Cowley permission to sue them again. That would make no sense. They gave him a very significant concession as far as their retirement benefits to get him to resign and to be done with these allegations of improper termination. It's the same conduct was at issue, that it's an issue here, and that claim was completely resolved.
Well, why not just say that? What you read from the agreement is not the same as what you said after that. In other words, what you read from the agreement said that except as provided here, we're done.
Right. I mean, obviously, I wish it said more, but the fact is that the damages that they were settling were for the improper termination. The whole post-termination hearing was for this allegedly improper termination. I can't imagine what other rights we are settling if not the improper termination. And that's what the West Valley City attorneys who negotiated this agreement would have thought as well. So although it would have been nice if they were clear, I don't believe there's any ambiguity based on the stipulated agreement. Also, Kelly has never cited any cases that are analogous to this one, despite repeated attempts or repeated assertions on our part that there are no cases that are analogous. If a plaintiff prevails in his termination appeal, stipulates to an amount of a judgment, is given reinstatement, back pay, what more is there? There's no case that has said that a plaintiff can then go and pursue a procedural due process claim based on the same conduct. Now, if I move on to the actual alleged violation, Marks' involvement here, one of the things that Marks was required to determine, or the primary things that Marks was required to determine, were whether there were reasonable grounds to believe that the charges against the employee are true, and whether those charges support the proposed action. That is what's required of a decision maker here, and there's no allegation that Marks was biased as to those things. Marks looked at these very serious charges, and he found them to be confirmed. There was mishandling of evidence, there was mishandling of prisoners' property, and there was insubordination. And as this court is aware, insubordination is frequently grounds alone to terminate an employee. And in Marks's words, in both of his drafts of the letter, he says, "I find your conduct completely unacceptable. You have brought dishonor to the police department and the city, which has undermined the public's trust of the police department." In the end, Marks would have been a little more lenient to Cowley. He would have preferred to provide 240-hour suspension. But that doesn't mean that he thought that termination was unwarranted. It's Cowley's burden to show anything in the record, that shows that he thought that. And his testimony is very clear that he presented both options to the city. He said, "Yes, I prepared the letters. I discussed it with them," meaning city management, "and they elected the termination." And he says, "The other discipline I recommended was, if they wanted, termination." These are both options that Marks thought were warranted, and although he would have preferred one of them, due process is not violated by the city's election of the termination remedy. In the Hoover case, the court upheld summary judgment in a similar situation where the employee did not point to any evidence in the record suggesting that the relevant decision maker had decided in advance of the pre-termination hearing that nothing he heard there would have changed his mind. And that's where we're at here. There's just speculation that maybe this wasn't subject to revision, but that's not our burden to disprove. That's the plaintiff's or the appellant's burden on summary judgment to show. And then finally, an issue that wasn't brought up here. Under controlling Tenth Circuit law, if there is an adequate post-termination hearing that results in reinstatement and back pay, that completely cures the constitutional violation. And plaintiff or Cowley cites Loving Gear v. City of Blackhawk, which relies on the Workman v. Jordan case, 32 F3rd 475, where this exact issue was addressed. And the court there said, "No deprivation of a property right stemming from an allegedly inadequate pre-termination hearing where a public employee's procedurally adequate post-termination hearing actually resulted in the employee's reinstatement together with back pay for the constitutionally protected property interest in employment." and then goes on to say that when a procedure produces full protection, we need not examine the procedure for error. That's the situation here. Now, moving on to the retaliatory prosecution claim. The first problem we have here, and the first reason that the district court granted summary judgment, was because there is no evidence of retaliatory motive in this case. If you look at Detective Greco, Kelly admits that there is no reason that Greco would have had any retaliatory motive. The underlying conduct, protected conduct, that Kelly alleges is that he disclosed misconduct within the NNU. Greco wasn't part of that. He wasn't part of city leadership. There's no reason that he would have any retaliatory animus. And so Kelly says, well, there must have been someone in the city that didn't like Kelly. And that's just pure speculation. That didn't like him based on his speech, I should say. That's pure speculation. There's nothing in the record that connects these two things. This idea that Kelly spoke in March 2013 and his eventual prosecution over 14 months later in June 2014. I may have missed the dates there. March 2013 is when he spoke, and then over a year later is when he was eventually prosecuted. There's no connection between those things. And Kelly cites Smith v. Mashner to argue this kind of circumstantial evidence is there. But the circumstantial evidence in that case was that a plaintiff had gone and spoken in court against his employer, and then immediately upon his return from the court, there were retaliatory actions taken against him. That's not the case here. There's just no temporal proximity, nothing to tie in this allegedly retaliatory motive into the city's actions here. And then additionally, the DA's office acted fully independently in this prosecution. So once the evidence was turned over to the DA's office in March 2013, they assembled a prosecutorial panel. They went through the procedure. And by August 2013, they had independently determined that the shooting was unjustified. There's no allegation by Kelly that the city had anything to do with that determination. That was completely independent. And then Kelly wants to say, well, months later, there was some sort of urging that caused them to file charges. There's also nothing in the record that suggests that's the case either, to link those things. Kelly points to this sort of what he calls an ambiguity in the timing of this prosecutorial or this panel, this charging panel that was assembled, of which Greco was alleged to be a part. The only evidence in the record is by Nakamura that took place in October 2013. Kelly has never provided any other evidence in the record that suggests that happened after April 2014. And the reason April 2014 is significant is because at that point, Nakamura reached out and tried to get Dowland and Greco to participate in a charging decision. He said, we want to determine who and what to charge. This is April 2014. At that point, they hadn't made up their mind. And the city, realizing that there could be some potential issues if they got involved, said, as part of the checks and balances, the final review and charging decision appropriately rests with the DA's office. So they determined that Greco and Dallin wouldn't even participate in this final charging panel to decide who and what to charge. And so there's just no basis for saying that Greco had anything to do with the ultimate charging decision. And then the court was pointed out concerns about Greco just being only the signature, or I guess only the signatory to the information. Kelly, in his own deposition, admitted that Coach Redimos, a detective with Salt Lake City, could have signed the probable cause statement. His statements of probable cause are throughout the information, and he ultimately testified at trial. Rather than respond to that in the reply brief, Kelly just omits that. He focuses his attention elsewhere. That alone is proof for this court that charges would have been brought regardless of whether Greco or Dowland were the ultimate person to sign the information. Now, before the district court, Kelly made a significant admission. He was trying to get some more information from DA's witnesses as to their charging decision, so they wouldn't have to rely so much on speculation. And he alleged that without knowing the process, plaintiff will be unable to establish retaliatory prosecution, specifically the role West Valley City played. This was after discovery had taken place. The record then is the record now. And Kelly was ultimately denied the opportunity to re-examine these district attorneys, DA's office witnesses. So just as then, he cannot prove West Valley City's involvement in the prosecution. Now, I'll briefly move on to the attorney's fees issue. I know we didn't get to that with appellant. But the district court has broad discretion whether to award or deny attorney's fees. And on appeal, that decision is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, the underlying factual findings for clear error. And Callie points to a number of alleged issues that are not really at issue here. The first one is that the motion was not made under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 37A5. That's the rule that Callie relied on to request attorney's fees. That rule only applies to a motion for an order compelling disclosure or discovery. And as the district court recognized, the defendants or the appellees had already responded to plaintiff's discovery requests. And in response to such production, plaintiff contended the duplicates were precluded by Rule 26G. That was a portion of the attorney's fees motion that Kelly made, was under 26G. The other part was for a waiver of privilege of some of the produced documents. That also wasn't a motion to compel. Those documents had been produced. They were trying to be clawed back, and so they weren't under a motion to compel discovery. The second reason that the district court denied the motion for fees was that it had granted in part and denied in part the underlying discovery motion. And there are two real reasons that this should be upheld. The district court cited one of those as being that the documents have been narrowed down to 78 documents. Now, Callie points out that that happened by consent of the parties. But really, within those 78 documents, the court still found that some of those were privileged. He upheld the privilege on those documents that were drafted by outside counsel and addressed to an attorney within West Valley City that remained privileged. And Callie, on appeal, he challenges this. He says that he's not aware of any documents that fall under that category. That's not in the record before the court. I've personally reviewed those documents. I found one of those. It's not in the record. I can't present it here. It has not properly been presented to this court for appeal. And the other issue is that the court did not require the appellees to parse out duplicative emails within an email conversation. Now, what Kelly argues is that he didn't request that kind of relief, and so it wasn't up for the district court to deny that. But the transcript of the hearing shows otherwise. Mr. Baczynski said, the court asked him, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, what we would request is that the court have opposing counsel take out all the duplicates, leave us with one copy of each document, and it will take that work away from me. And the district court didn't grant this full request. It said that it would not require the appellees to parse out duplicative emails. And then finally, the third grounds is that the court found that the circumstances made an award of costs unjust in this case. As the court said, this court finds that there was not sufficient care taken by counsel for either party in the request for documents and the responses thereto. Plaintiff's counsel did not use good judgment when they made similar document requests as to each defendant. And there's really no issue there. The court has these document requests. Duplicative document requests were made to each of the individual eight defendants. Very, very broad document requests. And the city attempted to comply with that by producing the documents in a certain way that created duplicates. And the court criticized appellees for that as well. But both sides were at fault in this issue, and the court used that as a very valid grounds to deny attorney's fees. So if there's nothing further, thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. There is a general dispute of fact as to whether Cowley's termination was predetermined. There's also a general dispute of fact as to the role that West Valley City's advocacy played in bringing charges that lacked probable cause. On that basis, Your Honors, I would ask that both of those questions be submitted to a jury for determination. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. The case is submitted. The court stands in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.